Okay. All right. Well, we're all good. We might as well get going. Again, this is tonight. This is Tulip Mania. We've kind of backtracked, if you will. We started out with the Mississippi Bubble. We go to the South Sea Bubble. We go to the 1920s. We go to Japan, and then of course Vegas. Vegas last week, and now I'm circling back to Tulip Mania. And if you read into it, then I'm sure that maybe you can see why I circled back to this rather than started with this, because it is quite a bit different than the other episodes that we've looked at. And I gave you quite a few readings on this, things I've written. And of course, The Truth About Tulip Mania was article that was published on Mises.org, and but originally in the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, and it was essentially taken from two chapters from the book, or from my thesis, if you will. And this is, by the way, if you're interested in the story, great, and if you're not interested in the story, then that's too bad, because I'm going to tell you the story anyway. But this is the part of my thesis that Murray thought I'd really made a contribution about, because there hasn't been anyone who had applied Austrian theory to Tulip Mania. And so he had urged me to put this into an article and shop it to various mainstream economic journals. Well, I did. And I was turned down 7 or 8 times. And for the most part, mainstream economic journals do not recognize the Austrian school. And they certainly weren't going to have any positive view of a completely different take on Tulip Mania. And so I was turned down 7 or 8 times, and of course this takes a long time, because you at the back in those days, at least, you made physical copies of all your articles, and you ship them off, and they send them out for blind refereeing. And of course, the referees, take weeks and months to get back to you, and eventually they just turn the thing down. And most of the referees don't offer anything interesting in terms of help, in terms of what they see as wrong. And so Murray was very, very sympathetic to my plight, and we exchanged letters over this. And he told me that that's why he didn't submit to any of the mainstream economic journals anymore, that the referees were a pack of morons, as he put it, and didn't understand what you were trying to write about, and they certainly didn't know what was going on. So when I saw him for the last time, he had said, well, of course, we will publish this in the Review of Austrian Economics. And then he died. He died less than a month after that. I never saw him again. And but the manuscript had gone out to the Review of Austrian Economics. Well, guess what? They turned it down too. And it wasn't until, oh, 2 or 3 years ago that the article was resurrected and was published by the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. So that's kind of the story of the article Tulip, The Truth About Tulip Mania. And it also, for those of you who I think you have an interest in academia and publishing and doing projects like that. It's terribly frustrating. You send off your articles to a black hole, and you have people you have no idea who they are, this blind refereeing sort of system that goes on, and they may or may not know anything about the subject you're talking about, and they get to weigh in and essentially decide, you know, whether your piece is going to be published or not. So anyway, it's a terribly frustrating system, and it's something that those in academia unfortunately have to constantly go through, because it's a publish or perish sort of existence that they go through. Now, something else that was on the reading list was my review of Ann Golgar's book, Tulip Mania and the Econo-Cultural Breakdown. Very interesting book. If I get to this, it'll be at the very end. But she had a completely, I wouldn't say a completely different take on it, but certainly a different take on Tulip Mania. Also, I think I had a review in there of a fiction book. And I forgot what it was. I don't have it in front of me, but there was a fiction book that was set, a story that was set within Tulip Mania, and that was really actually quite well done. And that book moved very quickly. There was thought that book was going to be made into a movie, and I forgot who the director is. I think I mentioned it in the review of who has the movie rights to that. It would make a very interesting story, and with all the bubbles and busts we have going on right now, I think it would be very timely. So it would be wonderful if someone would pursue that story, because I think it's very, very interesting and really portrays the setting that was going on at that time, which of course reminds me of, there's the article going around about the Atlas Shrugged production, anybody needs that link to that to the article about what's going on with the making of the movie Atlas Shrugged, I can send that out later. But needless to say, that has been a protracted project that appears to be just barely getting off the ground, and maybe done in a trilogy sort of fashion. It's a $5 million budget, no big name stars, but it would be very interesting, obviously, to see Atlas Shrugged made into a movie. So anyway, we'll see. Yeah, there it is. Grayson is all over this. Paul Johansson is the director, and of course he's going to not only direct, he's going to star. And so at least one of my movie experts out there has indicated that doesn't always work out well, but of course many of us are rooting for Atlas Shrugged to be made into a movie. But anyway, I'm getting a little bit off topic here. Let's dig into Tulip Mania. Really, Tulip Mania has turned into a metaphor. Many of the bubbles and busts that have occurred throughout history have been called not bubbles and busts or booms and crashes. They've been called Tulip Manias. So that's how important it was in history, in terms of really being the first episode of this kind. And by the way, even though I've given you the truth about Tulip Mania and these other things, the notes that I'm working off tonight are not from those sources, at least initially. The notes that I'm working off of are actually Chapter 2 and Chapter 3 of Early Speculative Bubbles and Increases in the Supply of Money. So if it's a little bit different than what you've read, I mean, it's basic The journal article is basically a combination of those two chapters, but I'm actually working off the actual two chapters as I talk tonight. But anyway, the Tulip Mania has been described in the new Palgrave Dictionary's Economics as situations in which some prices behave in a way that appears not to be fully explainable by economic fundamentals. So what's very interesting is when you go to Palgrave and look up Tulip Mania, you wouldn't find anything about the actual episode, but you would find that particular definition. And it's very interesting that it kind of morphed into this metaphor, if you will. Now, the guy that, if there's a foil in this story, my foil, if you will, is Peter Garber. And Peter Garber is a Brown University economist, at least he was when I wrote this, and he's made his living writing about Tulip Mania, as near as I can tell. He's written numerous journal articles, he's written at least one book, and he has been the go-to guy in terms of Tulip Mania. And I certainly went to him in terms of the facts and figures and price movements and some of the nitty-gritty details of how bulbs were purchased in the futures market and those kind of things. But as you will find out, is that Garber is he's in the rational expectation school, and he believes that Tulip Mania wasn't a bubble at all, that the price increase in the price of these tulips could be explained by their scarcity on the market. And so he's essentially the guy that we're in a way up against in terms of or at least in looking at the Austrian view. It's the Austrian school tonight versus the rational expectation school. So anyway, I think I'd also put in the reading the chapter from Charles McKay's Memoirs of Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds, of which everybody leans on. Everybody's been leaning on for a long time. McKay wrote some wonderful prose about this episode and many, many others. In fact, I think he wrote on the Mississippi Bubble as well. So Charles McKay did some wonderful work. And what Charles McKay, the reason that people have been reading his books for a long, long time and will continue to read it for a long, long time, is that anytime there's a bubbles and bust, people wonder what went on, and they want to look back at past episodes, and he tells such a vibrant tale of chimney sweeps and these various people that got sucked into buying tulips. I think he had the story where one of the sailors mistakes a tulip bulb for an onion and takes a bite out of it. Of course, it's very valuable tulip bulb. So, anyway, that's everybody leans on McKay and as they should. But as if you read Ann Golgar's piece, she believes that McKay's information was a bit faulty, and that he overstates this whole bubble idea because of a faulty source. But we'll get to that later. Just to talk about the bubble or the tulip. You know, they weren't actually trading the flowers; they were trading the bulbs. And with a tulip, it's a bulb flower. It can reproduce either by seed or through buds formed on female bulbs. The flowers of the tulip appear in April and May, and they're only in bloom for about a week. And the bulbs can be removed from the ground in June, but must be replanted again in September. And these extraordinary patterns that appeared on some of the tulips is called by a mosaic virus. And they can't be duplicated by seed reproduction. It's only cultivated, can only be cultivated, the affected buds into new bulbs. By cultivating the affected buds can duplication occur. And the problem with this virus is that it subdues the rate of reproduction. Thus, the tulips with the more exotic patterns were slower to reproduce, and that was making them more scarce and valuable than the common unaffected bulbs. And so tulips are somewhat of a peculiar flower that way, and so that's why you had some of these bulbs being somewhat more valuable than others. But as again we'll see by the end of this story, even the common bulbs took off during this boom. So anyway, Garber makes in his discussion of the bulb market that it really the market was limited to professional growers until 1634. And again, this story really goes from 1634 to 1637. And then speculators entered the market, driven by high demand for the bulbs in France. Common bulbs traded in standard units of 1,000 azen or 1 pound, and with contracts not referring to specific bulbs at all, and just essentially sold in bulk. Given the growing season mentioned above, the tulip market was a futures market. I mean, it was essentially a futures market from September to June, because the bulbs were in the ground. And Garber indicates that the formal futures market began 1634, and were the primary vehicle for the trading bulbs until 1637, when the market collapsed. And then, like I say, this story goes for, you know, really about a relatively short period of time. Certainly ends in February of 1637. So summer of 1636, trading and futures take place in taverns, which were called colleges. They had a few rules restricting the bidding and the fees. Buyers were required to put up a small fraction of the contracted amount of each deal for what they called wine money. Again, this is very similar to other bubbles we've looked at, both the Mississippi bubble, South Sea bubble, certainly anything where high leverage was used. You didn't need to put a lot of money down, put a small amount of money down, hoping to leverage that into a big gain. But other than that, no margin, according to Garber, was required by either the buyer or seller. On the settlement date, buyers did not typically have the required cash to sell the trade, but the sellers did not have the bulbs either. Thus, the trade was settled with only a payment of the difference between the contract and settlement price being expected. Contracts were not repeatedly marked to the market. Thus, when the market collapsed, gross positions rather than net had to be unwound. So when the market collapsed in February 1637, no bulbs were delivered under the deals consummated by the new futures market. Bulbs could not be delivered in June. They were still in the ground. It was February. So Garber says that it was unclear as to the settlement date and the price of these transactions. And the rare bulbs began to trade in increasingly higher prices in 1635, but it was 1636 when trading in the common bulbs really began. And there was a writer named N.W. Posthumus said the following concerning the timing of the events. He wrote, "I think the sequence of events may be seen as follows. At the end of 1634, the new non-professional buyers came into action. Towards the middle of 1635, prices rose rapidly while people could buy on credit, generally delivering at once some article of value. At the same time, the sale per AAS was announced. I would say that as ass, but I, you know, my pronunciations continue to get ridiculed during these broadcasts, so I should probably just pass, but it's spelled AAS. About the middle of 1636, the colleges appeared, and soon thereafter the trade in non-available bulbs was started, while in November the same year the trade was extended to the common varieties, and bulbs were sold by the thousand of azen and per pound. So that's probably a good layout of the timeline of how tulip mania occurred. And the price of most bulbs exploded. They exploded upward to February 5th, 1637. And then they plunged downward the same day. And the graph of the Gouda bulb indicates that the price peaked on January 29th, crashed on February 5th. That's, you know, that was pretty much the same with all of the bulbs. They peaked in price in February of 1637, and then they crashed. And after the market crash in the first week of February, delegations of Florence and Amsterdam made a proposal that tulip sales contracts consummated before October 30th of 1636 should be executed, but the transactions occurring after that date could be rescinded by the buyer upon payment of 10% of the sales price to the seller. However, the Dutch authorities came up with their own plan, and that was to suspend all contracts. So the Dutch authorities stepped in, they suspended all contracts, and that's what happened. Sellers could then sell their contracted bulbs at market prices during the suspension. And buyers are responsible for the difference between the market price and the settlement price decided by the authorities. Growers released to market bulbs to be exhumed in June, and Garber goes on to explain that the disposition of further contracts is not clear. But the example of the city of Harlem's solution is cited by Posthumus, which permitted buyers to cancel contracts with the payment of 3.5% of the contract price. After Garber's kind of gone through all the historical background of what happened, then he talks about, well, was this episode a tulip mania? Even though he's talking about tulip mania, he's wondering, well, is this tulip mania? And you know, as I said before, he doesn't really think so. He thinks that there was a perfect reason why the price of bulbs exploded in price, the rare prices went up, and that's what explained it. He also says that in spite of the crash, little wealth was transferred, given that only small settlements on contracts were required. You know, he essentially makes the case that Annie Goldgar does, is that this tulip mania really didn't affect a lot of people. Where we've seen in the South Sea bubble and Mississippi bubble and certainly the recent housing bubble that we've looked at, where we see a lot of bankruptcies, we see a lot of people that were you know, harmed throughout the economy. Garber makes the case, and Golgar makes the case in her piece, in her book, that not many people were affected like this, and that that it really didn't matter the economy. Garber comes to the conclusion that the bulb speculation was not obvious madness, at least for most of the 34 to 37 mania. Only the last month of the speculation for common bulbs remains a potential bubble, according to him. And of course, he can't explain, he can't put any market fundamentals to explain why the Witt-Kroonen bulb rose by approximately 26 times in January of 1637. I mean, 26 times, that's an increase of 2,600%, is an extraordinarily extraordinary rise in prices, and of course it fell to 1/20th of its peak price in the very next month, within a few weeks. So, you know, you did have this amazing speculation. You had this extraordinary increase and then fall of prices, but then Garber, even though he can't explain it, he contends that it's not really a bubble, but he does say he'd be hard-pressed to find a market fundamental explaining these relative price movements. And he also, in later writings, I didn't pick this up necessarily when I was writing on my thesis, but he starts leaning toward this idea that I did pick up for the QJ article, that there was a plague in Holland at the time, and bubonic plague, and he cites that as a potential reason for tulip mania. That I mean, I called it a fatalistic extension of Keynes's animal spirits hypothesis, where people are going to die. We're gonna die anyway, so let's throw a little money at the tulip mania, or try to make a fortune trading tulip bulbs. I really can't imagine that if you're worried about dying of the plague. I don't think running down to a tavern and speculating in tulip bulbs is the first thing on your mind. And I certainly don't think it was the first thing on the minds of a lot of people in Amsterdam at the time. But it's interesting that he kind of, Garber, over time, the more he's looked at this episode, he's kind of gone from the rational, really the two things that are the polar opposites. One is rational expectations. Of course, rational expectations, as we talked about before, says that everybody has all information they need to trade in a market, and thus you can't have bubbles. And then Keynes's animal spirits essentially says that we're all irrational all the time, you know, the government needs to step in and control these things. Well, you know, Garber's kind of gone from rational expectations over time to kind of a form of animal spirits with this bubonic plague idea. So, to me, it's not terribly convincing. But that's, as I say, he's the guy that's really made a living writing about tulip mania and all these years. So he's been kind of the go-to guy. Um, I talk a little bit, I'm not sure in the article, but certainly in chapter two, about Charles Kindlebarger, and he wrote a book called Manias, Panics, and Crashes, A History of Financial Crisis. And Kindlebarger has really written some good stuff. He's not an Austrian, but this is a good book, Manias, Panics, and Crashes. And I remember Murray talking about Kindlebarger. He said he liked him because he wasn't a teetotaler. I guess Charles. I don't know if he's still alive or not, but he used to like to have a drink, I guess. So anyway, Murray kind of liked him for that. But anyway, he's written some good stuff, and he. But about tulip mania, he's just very scant attention to it in his book, and it's one of the, you know, in addition to Charles McKay, Kindlebarger is one of these go-to guys on this subject, and he wrote mania such as the Lubeck crisis 100 years earlier or the tulip mania of 1634. Are too isolated and lack the characteristic monetary features that come with the spread of banking after the opening of the 18th century. Peter Garber has dealt at length with the tulip mania. He distinguishes a bubble from ordinary economic fluctuations. The latter are determined by fundamentals, while the former deviates from the set of prices that fundamentals would call for. In Tulip Mania, Kindlebarger writes, and he's writing about Garber, which he suggests was not a bubble. The fundamental accounting for the enormous rise of some tulip prices was the difficulty of producing them. So he really doesn't think that a tulip mania was a mania at all. Doesn't think it was a bubble or a crash. Another book by Kindlebarger is The Financial History of Western Europe. And interestingly enough, in that book, he called tulip mania probably the high watermark in bubbles. So even though he says it doesn't have the characteristics of being a bubble. In another book, he says probably tulip mania was the high watermark in bubbles. But when he writes about it, he has this quote that tulip mania lacked the characteristic monetary features that come with the spread of banking in the 18th century, which was in the previous quote, and. Kindlebarger was very well aware of what we've been talking about this entire class, about the monetary aspects of creating manias and bubbles. He writes, speculative manias gather speed through the expansion of money and credit, or perhaps in some cases get started because of the initial expansion of money and credit. One can look back at particular manias followed by crashes or panics and see what went wrong. Again, Kindlebarger is not an Austrian, but certainly has looked at enough history to see how bubbles and manias get started. But what I think Kindlebarger misses, and certainly Garber misses, is the monetary aspect of tulip mania. And that's what I go into in chapter three, is a chapter called Free Coinage, the Bank of Amsterdam, and Tulip Mania. And this is really the Austrian version of this story. And of course, it takes a while to set up. We have to go back to the fall of the Roman Empire and many different money systems developed throughout Europe. Of course, if, as This is before John Law. This is before the South Sea Bubble. This is back when you had coins were being used as money. Now, kings, emperors, rulers wanted to expand the money supply for their own purposes, like the rulers do today, whether elected or not. And it was much more difficult in those days. And what they did was something called sweating, clipping, or crying the coins. And what the king would do is take the coins and clip off a little edge of them over time, and take the metal clippings and recoin them. Of course, the coin would be at a lighter weight, but they would call it the same denomination. So, and then they'd create new coins with the shavings that they had created. So, in 1524, Charles V had raised the value of he's the kind of the guy that ruler that got this started. These alterations in the Netherlands came by monetary degree. He wasn't as much of a clipper as just coming out with the monetary decree, and he raised the value of gold coins from 9 or 10 to 11 and 3/8 time their weight in silver. And so that's what he would do to, depending on what the treasury was holding money-wise, would alter the value of silver coins or silver as opposed to gold. This has happened throughout history, and it's happened here in the 1500s. And in 1542, Charles returned the ratio to 10 to 1, not by lowering the value of gold coins back to their value, but by degrading the silver coins. These actions served to first overvalue, then undervalue gold in relation to its market value to silver, with the result being that the overvalued money drove the undervalued money out of circulation. And I make the point that this is known as Gresham's Law. And of course, when you hear Gresham's Law, you hear that it's bad money drives out good money. But it really, Gresham's Law is that money overvalued by the state, by state decree, drives undervalued money out of circulation, so that only the overvalued begins to circulate. So a silver ducat went from 54 grams fine down to 35 grams down fine. The silver coins began the primary circulating medium in Holland. This action reduced the value of the circulating money supply by 1/3 from its value in 1523, raised the value of gold nearly 50%. And by this device, Charles was able to replenish his dwindling treasury. You may remember that I've referred to FDR when he confiscated gold in the United States in the early 30s. When he took office, he confiscated the gold at $20 an ounce and immediately revalued it once he had confiscated it. So this is something that... It's something the kings and rulers, either elected by democratic processes or not, have been going on for a long time. So this transgression, which took place in 1546, is the straw that broke the patience of his long-suffering subjects. And this sparked an upheaval known as the Confederation of Beggars, formed in 1566, 6 years later, The revolution was proclaimed. One of the first measures instigated by the revolutionary government was free or individual coinage. And this is very important in this story, free or individual coinage, which is explained by economic historian Helfferich. And he explains the simple and best known special case of unrestricted transformation of metal into money is that known as the right of free coinage or coinage for private account. The state will mint coins out of any quantity of metal delivered to it, either by making no charge to the person delivering the metal or merely a very small charge to cover cost. Person delivering the metal receives in coin from the mint the quantity of the metal delivered up to him, either without any deduction or with a very small deduction for centerage. And so this is very important to this story because that's eventually what the Bank of Amsterdam does, is institutes free coinage, which leads to a tremendous amount of metal and coin appearing or being attracted to Amsterdam and Holland. So we have a huge rise in the money supply, not by fractionalized banking, not by fiat banking, not by the use of a central bank, but actually hard money, 100%. But we'll get to that. I'm getting ahead of myself. So anyway, the idea of free coinage is brought to the Netherlands by the Dutch East Indians, and they had inherited the concept from the Portuguese, and so free coinage was an immediate success. Possessors of silver and gold coin, gold bullion obtained in America, quote, had vainly sought to evade the coinage exactions of the European princes. Now the door of escape was open. They had only to be sent to Holland, turned into guilders and ducats, and credited as silver metal under the name of Sols Blanco. As the 17th century began, the Dutch were the driving force behind European commerce. Amsterdam was the capital of Holland. It was a central point of trade. Amsterdam's currency consisted primarily of coins in the neighboring countries and to a lesser extent its own coins. Many of these foreign coins were worn. They were damaged. As we said earlier, they'd been clipped, they'd been sweated, they'd been cried, thus they were reducing the value of Amsterdam's currency by about 9% below that of the standard, and thus it was impossible to infuse any new coins into circulation. New coins go into circulation at the proper weight. Of course, the old damaged clipped coins would trade and the new coins would not. Upon the circulation of newly minted coins, these newly minted coins were collected, melted down, exported as bullion. Place in circulation was quickly taken by the newly imported, clipped, or sweated coins. Thus, undervalued money was driven out by overvalued or degraded money due to the legal tender status of these degraded coins. So you can see how this would happen. So to remedy the situation, the Bank of Amsterdam, was originated in 1609. The bank was, and it was set up to facilitate trade, suppress usury, have a monopoly on all trading of specie, but the bank's chief function was the withdrawal of these abused and counterfeit coins from circulation. Coins were taken in as deposits with credits, known as bank money issued against these deposits, based not on the face value of the coin, but on the metal weight. Or the intrinsic value of the coins. Thus, a perfectly uniform currency was being created by the Bank of Amsterdam. This feature of the new money, along with its convenience, security, and the city of Amsterdam guarantee, and this guarantee, if you had your money in the Bank of Amsterdam, they were bound for the coins and bullion security, number one. and also against fire, robbery, or any other incident. It's what a bank should be. Put your money in, put your coin in, and they're responsible for the security of it. And at the time, they weren't lending any of it out. 100% reserves, and according to the original charter, the Bank of Amsterdam could not lend out its deposits. And so with this guarantee, the bank money actually traded at an agio, or a premium, over the coins. The premium varied from 4 to 6.25%, but generally represented the depreciation rate of coin below its nominal or face value. So the Bank of Amsterdam actually provided this service, and their money actually traded at a premium of the coin and bullion. Now, one of the services that the bank provided was to transfer upon order from one depositor deposits to the account of a creditor by book entry. So they also provided a service that people wanted. You could store your coin with the Bank of Amsterdam. If you wanted to pay a merchant or a supplier or your brother-in-law or whatever the case may be, they would transfer it on their books. And this was called a giro banking operation. It was so popular that the withdrawal of deposits from the bank became a very rare occurrence. Money came into the Bank of Amsterdam. It stayed there. Stayed there because it was secure, and the bank actually provided a service. The bank wasn't strong because it turned around and lent the money back out. They end up doing that later, but initially, they provided this great 100% banking service. If a depositor wanted to regain his specie, he could easily find a buyer for his bank money and at a premium due to its convenience. Additionally, there was a demand for bank money from people not having an account with the bank. And the guy who wrote a lot about this, who I leaned on when writing my thesis about Bank of Amsterdam, was actually Adam Smith. Adam Smith writes about the Bank of Amsterdam extensively in The Wealth of Nations. And he writes, by demanding payment of the bank, the owner of the bank credit would lose his premium. City of Amsterdam's guarantee, in addition to the requirement that all bills be drawn upon or negotiated in Amsterdam, the amount of 600 guilders or more must be paid in bank money, took away all uncertainty in the value of the bills, and thus forced all merchants to keep an account at the bank, which necessarily occasioned a certain demand for the bank money. And he goes on to explain the mechanics of how the Bank of Amsterdam issued bank money, and it's kind of interesting, and in a way it's kind of confusing. The bank would give credit bank money in its books for gold and silver bullion that was deposited at roughly 5% below the bullion's then current mint value. Okay, give you credit 5% below. Same time as this bank credit was issued, the depositor would receive a receipt that entitled the depositor or the bearer to draw the amount of bullion deposited with the bank within 6 months of the deposit. Now, to retrieve the bank deposit, a person had to present to the bank a receipt for the bullion and an amount of bank money equal to the book entry, and a payment of 0.25% fee for silver and 0.5% fee for gold deposits. So to keep money in the bank, you had to pay them for the deposit. It was kind of like checking account fees, which we don't see anymore because banks, they get your money now and they lend it out. So they advertise free checking. Well, in a 100% banking environment, what you have is you have to pay the bank to keep your money there. And if you don't pay that, if the six-month term expires, well, then that's where that 5% discount, as I mentioned, when you put your bullion in the Bank of Amsterdam, you're given credit for 5% less than the bullion rate. Well, they collect that 5% then if you don't essentially pay the fee to continue for to have that on deposit. The higher fee was charged for gold due to the fact that gold was thought to be riskier to warehouse, which makes perfect sense because of its higher value. Receipt for bullion was rarely allowed to expire. When it did, more often than not, was for a gold deposit because of the higher deposit fee. So it was a very, very sound system of banking. Adam Smith goes on, and this is a fairly lengthy quote, but it may it may be instrumental because you had two different instruments that were created by this, separate instruments that were combined to create an obligation of the Bank of Amsterdam. And Smith explains this, and again, this is a fairly lengthy quote, but I think it's instructive. The person who, by making a deposit of bullion, obtains both a bank credit and a receipt, pays his bills of exchange as they become due with his bank credit, and either sells or keeps his receipt according to as he judges the price of bullion is likely to rise or fall. The receipt and the bank credit seldom keep long together, and there is no occasion that they should. The person who has a receipt and who wants to take out bullion finds always plenty of bank credits or bank money to buy at ordinary price, and the person who has bank money and wants to take out bullion finds receipts always in equal abundance. The holder of a receipt cannot draw out the bullion for which it is granted without reassigning to the bank a sum of bank money equal to the price at which the bullion had been received. If he has no bank money of his own, he must purchase it of those who have it. The owner of the bank money cannot draw out bullion without producing to the bank receipts for the quantity which he wants. If he has none of his own, he must buy them of those who have them. The holder of the receipt, when he purchases bank money, purchases the power of taking out a quantity of bullion of which the mint price is 5% above the bank price. The agio of 5%, therefore, which he commonly pays for it, is paid not for an imaginary, but for a real value. The owner of bank money, when he purchases a receipt, purchases the power of taking out a quantity of bullion, of which the market price is commonly from 2 to 3% above the mint price. The price which he pays for it, therefore, is paid likewise for a real value. The price of the receipt and the price of the bank money compound or make up between them full value, or the price of the bullion. And the same system applied to coins or bullion, and, you know, either which way. And Smith does assert that deposits of coinage were more likely to fall to the bank than deposits of bullion. But it was an extraordinarily sound banking system, again based on 100% reserves. Smith writes, "The Bank of Amsterdam has for these many years past been the great warehouse of Europe for bullion, for which the receipts are very seldom allowed to expire, or, as they express it, to fall to the bank. The far greater part of the bank money or of the credits upon the books of the bank is supposed to have been created for these many years past by such deposits which the dealers in bullion are continually both making and withdrawing." So you had this great banking system. Again, publication date of The Wealth of Nations was 1776. So he's writing more than 100 years after this took place, but recognized the sound banking system of the Bank of Amsterdam. And as you remember, Bank of Amsterdam served as a inspiration to John Law. John Law looked at the operations of the Bank of Amsterdam and saw that what a bank can do for commerce And at that point, obviously saw Sound Banking was very good. Of course, as the bank later, by the time that Law was probably looking at it, they had actually began making large loans to the city of Amsterdam and to one of the local trading companies, and that's probably what he took his inspiration from more than anything. But the Bank of Amsterdam and the Sound money, combined with the free coinage, served to attract huge deposits to the Bank of Amsterdam. So the bank was highly profitable for the city of Amsterdam. A new depositor paid a fee of 10 guilders to open an account. Subsequent account, they had to pay 3 guilders. Transfers, 2 guilders. For small transfers, it was 6 guilders because they wanted to discourage small transfers. A fee of 3% was charged if the depositor ordered a transfer for more than the amount in the account. And in the beginning, the Bank of Amsterdam did not perform, as I write in here, a credit function. It was strictly a deposit bank. All bank money was 100% 100% reserves. Eventually, they did make large loans to the Dutch East Indian Company and the municipality of Amsterdam. And by 1790, word of these loans became public. The premium for the bank money, which we'd mentioned earlier, which is usually 4%, sometimes as high as 6.25%, disappeared. It fell to a 2% discount. And by the end of 1790, the bank virtually admitted insolvency by issuing a notice that silver would be sold to holders of bank money at a 10% discount. City of Amsterdam took over the bank in 1791, eventually closed it for good in December of 1819. So again, Bank of Amsterdam started in 1609, 100% reserve bank, very sound. But again, by 1790, the loans that they had made, which they had tried to do clandestinely, I guess, word leaked out, and of course their soundness was questioned, and eventually the bank went out of business. And so the other thing happening here, we have free coinage, remember, and we've got the stability of the Bank of Amsterdam. And then the other thing that's happened is that we have huge amounts of precious metals being discovered in America. And of course, Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492, and he showed up, and then Cortez invaded Mexico in 1519, and an influx of precious metals into Europe began, principally through Spain. The other thing that happened that was very much needed was there was a mine in Peru, a mercury mine, the Huan Cavelleclia mine. Of course, that's the way we would say it in Abilene. I'm sure I butchered that name, but that mine was found 1572, and mercury is needed for the amalgamation process. There was also a Japanese silver mining industry that was also expanding at this very time. So you had metal coming from Mexico. You had it coming from Japan and South America, and so there was a tremendous amount of metal that was being mined and coming to Europe. Dennis Flynn writes that American output of bullion in conjunction with the output of Central Europe and Japanese mines increased the world supply of silver significantly to slowly drive its market value downward. That is, There was price inflation in the 16th century. American and non-American mines produced such an enormous quantity of silver that its market value dropped to a level below the cost of producing it in a growing number of European mines. So we had a huge amount of mining going on. Francis Walker wrote that from 1570 to 1640, silver sank rapidly. Corn rose from about 2 ounces of silver the quarter to 6 or 8 ounces. David Hume wrote, by the most exact computations that have been formed all over Europe after making allowance for the alterations in the numerary value or denomination, has found that the prices of all things have risen 3-4 times since the discovery of the West Indies. So this huge silver production was raising prices. You had an influx of bullion that was making its way from Spain essentially up to Amsterdam. There was also, in addition to the mining, you had seizure of coin and bullion on the high seas. And in 1628 occurred the famous capture of the Spanish treasury fleet, netted 177,537 pounds weight of silver, jewels, valuable commodities. So you had coin and bullion being captured on the high seas as well. And what are you going to do with that bullion? You're going to take it where you can get it made into money for no fee. And that's what free coinage is all about. And that's what spurred money supply growth. So when we look at Spanish imports of fine gold and silver from America, it begins to really balloon in the late 1500s and continues on really until 1631 to 1640, both for silver and for gold. You have a tremendous amount of metal making its way there. Mint output and this is probably more important to our story, but the mint output of the southern Netherlands in 1630 to 1632, this is in guilders, in gold, 364,414 in gold, silver, 8,838,411. 1633 to 35, 476,996 in gold. Silver ballooned at more than it essentially doubled, 16,554,000 worth of guilders. 1636, 1638, gold balloons exponentially, 2,917,000 guilders worth of gold, and then 20,172,000 guilders worth of silver are minted. Remember that our dates for Tulip Mania are essentially 1634 to 1637. So you had this tremendous amount of metal that has flooded into Europe, and now it is being minted. The deposits at the Bank of Amsterdam grew tremendously, and from 1633 to 1638, the deposits grew from 5 million florins to 8 million florins, 60% increase in the deposits at the Bank of Amsterdam. So again, there's another indication of the amount of money there in there in Amsterdam. Delmar, Alexander Delmar, I believe his first name is Alexander, who I lean on extensively, writes that under the stimulus of free coinage, an immense quantity of precious metals now found their way to Holland, and a rise of prices ensued, which found one form of expression in the curious mania of buying tulips at prices often exceeding that of the ground on which they were grown. He goes on to discuss the end of tulip mania in 1648, when the Peace of Westphalia acknowledged the independence of the Dutch Republic. The latter stopped the free coinage of silver florins and only permitted it for gold ducats, which in Holland had no legal value. This legislation discouraged the imports of silver bullion, checked the rise of prices, and put an end to tulip mania. Well, as we know, 1648, the mania was essentially over. It had been all the contracts had been unraveled by the government, but it's interesting that he would write that, and he would recognize the monetary stimulus that had happened. There's another gentleman who's written extensively about at Holland at the time, a guy named Simon Schama, and he wrote, "In any event, the magistrates of the Dutch town saw niceties of equity as less pressing than the need to de-intoxicate the tulip craze. Their intervention was hastened by the urgency of returning the genie speculation to the bottle from which it had escaped and corking it tightly to ensure against any reoccurrence. To some extent, they could feel satisfied that the ineluctable operations of Fortuna had already punished the foolhardy by taking them from rags to riches and back again in short order, but they still felt impelled to launch a didactic campaign in tracts, sermons, and prints against folly, since its special wickedness had been in leading the common people astray." And it's at this point in chapter 3, I guess, where I show the number of annual bankruptcies in Amsterdam and Leiden, Haarlem, and Groningen, and there was a doubling of bankruptcies from 1635 to 1637, a doubling. You know, it's interesting, as we had found, as I talked about earlier, Garber and certainly Ann Golgar don't believe that this mania had affected anybody beyond a few people who traded in the tulip bulbs. If you see a doubling in bankruptcies, then I think it's an indication that a lot of people were caught up in the boom, and it's hard to imagine that only tulip growers would make up the increase in the bankruptcy. So I think some of the masses were caught up in trading tulip bulbs, and were certainly punished with their finances. And it's interesting that even in the case of Ann Golgar, she mentions that a number of people she chronicles numerous lawsuits that were spawned by tulip deals gone bad, and that some of the litigation lasted for years, even after the the tulip price had crashed in 1637. And that's because there was significant money at stake. She writes, as trade in tulips heated up, some buyers at least wanted whatever they could command the highest price. The fact that by this time some tulips could change hands many times before they flowered makes it clear that at this point tulips were valued by some only for their profitability. We're going to go back to Golgar in a minute, but that statement that she makes essentially undoes some of the claims she makes about the whole episode. But kind of to wrap up what I had written is that the interesting thing about Tulip Mania, and the reason that I wanted to go through the other episodes, and I didn't want to start with this one, is that the government policy did not expand the money supply through fractional reserve banking, which is the modern tool, but it was actually quite the opposite. Kings throughout Europe were debasing their currencies, and it was really a bank that provided 100% backed with specie banking money, very sound money, combined with all of this bullion and coin that was flooding into Europe, and the free coinage that was offered, it served to create more money from this increased supply of coin and bullion than the market demanded. And I think that's what's important to take a hold here. Hayek. I think I mentioned this in the new introduction to the book, that Hayek considers free coinage essentially a government intervention in the monetary markets that creates essentially too much money, more money than the market wants. So it's very interesting. Same cause of the bubble. The cause is the same, but the way the money was created was completely different. Now let's take a look at Anne Golgar's book, which I reviewed. It was on Mises.org. It's part of your reading list. And I actually reviewed this originally for the History of Economic Ideas in the fall of 2007. Out of the blue, they asked me to review this book, which I got a big charge out of that. But interesting book. And her point of view is that, as I write in a review, she essentially takes on McKay and his account of Tulip Mania being misplaced, and she contends that McKay's source was the propagandist Johann Beckmann, whose sources were suspect, according to Golgar, and she claims that it was not a big deal in terms of an economic event. After all, the Dutch economy wasn't destroyed after the bust, despite what some have written. Most of those who engaged in the tulip trade lived happily ever after, if they didn't die of the plague, that is. According to her, tulip mania was always been more of a warning than a historical event, she claimed. But we kind of have to look at Golgar's background here. Obviously, she's not a researcher who was digging up all this monetary historical facts and figures like I did. She's interested in finance and she's not interested in finance and economics. According to the website for King's College, where she teaches, she's interested in print culture of collecting, and the interaction of society, art, and science. So she's interested in the cultural aspect of Tulip Mania. And believe me, I'm not saying that's not valuable, because I think it is. I think she's done some extraordinary work. But she's not interested in the financial aspects of it. And so it's no real surprise that she's kind of poo-pooed that part of the story. But as I write here, she spends good part of the book developing this case that collecting tulips was really just an extent of collecting art. There was only a few people involved. It was the Dutch upper class. There were connoisseurs of flowers. There were not speculators, but collectors that knew the value and enjoyed their flowers for aesthetic reasons. Profit wasn't their motive, she writes, but their concept of rarity, their thrill when they found something strange, was always paramount. She chronicles all these lawsuits that were spawned because of these deals. And I'd given you the quote before that, you know, where she finishes by saying, at this point, the tulips were valued by some only for their profitability. Well, earlier in the book, she'd said, you know, this wasn't about profit and speculation at all. It was about their thrill that they found something strange. Well, I think she undoes her argument there, and she does that repeatedly in her book. Then she, of course, goes to Peter Garber, and like everybody does, because he's done a lot of, you know, a lot of work, and obviously I did too. And she writes, Tulip Mania was only irrational after the fact. If the market had held, it would have been supremely sensible to invest one's money in tulips. And she's essentially citing Garber. Of course, we can say that about anything. Everything that we've looked at, whether it was Mississippi Company stock, whether it was South Sea Company stock, homes in Las Vegas, Japanese real estate, the Nikkei Index, 1920s real estate. If the price would have continued on, it would have been a great investment. It was only crazy after the fact. Well, as I said last week, it's very easy to rationalize a bubble when you're inside of one, and it's hard to recognize one when you're in the middle of it. But, you know, she should, I think it's hard to make the case that Tulip Mania wasn't a mania, especially when we look at the Witt Cronin bulb, which went up 26 times in January of 1637. So obviously we had a huge boom and we had a huge crash, and she seems to want to look by that. Price bubble or not, the author's research, all the known sales and quarrels about sales, according to her, she looked at all the sales, and according to her, indicates less than 400 individuals were involved in the tulip trade. And she indicates that most of the traders were Mennonites, which is very interesting. They did the collecting and ultimate speculation. Their faith, the Mennonites' faith, kept them from holding public office, but they were frequently wealthy despite living unassuming lives. That's interesting that you have wealthy people who live unassumingly but are going down to local taverns speculating in tulip bulbs. Very, very interesting. Part of that, you know, doesn't seem to jibe. But the families tended to be very interconnected in her view, thus she explains the trading within the families as these people being very close. And so the whole idea of chimney sweeps and farmers and noblemen trading tulips, she believes is just plain not true. So thus the Charles Mackay version of the story is inaccurate in her view. As she writes, "We cast our eye down the list of tulip buyers and sellers. In fact, we become entangled in a whole web of family connections." And she goes on, and I mentioned in the review here that maybe not all the tulip sellers were Mennonites, but most came from a class below local government officials. And government officials, by the way, proposed a tax on tulip sales in the autumn of 1636, right before the crash, which sounds kind of familiar to many of our stories. Proposed taxes on stock sales have occurred recently, and of course, I know in the state of Nevada, there's been during the boom in housing, they increased real estate transfer taxes, etc. So, government always wants their piece of the action when a boom's going on. So. The tax record reveals that the Bloomists, if you will, were substantial citizens, average age of 39, which would have been fairly old at the time, typically involved in international trade, manufacturing, were professionals, doctors, or lawyers. So fairly well-to-do folks. She talks a little bit about how trade developed with rules. As she describes as kind of an informal order and authority. And she doesn't make reference to spontaneous order, but again, she's not an economist, not necessarily familiar with F.A. Hayek or even the Austrians, so she wouldn't necessarily come up with that. But she's got it's an interesting book. It's well worth reading if you're really interested in tulip mania. Certainly she writes well, and it's a nice little book. So I'll mention again that fiction book. I think it was called Tulip Fever. Maybe Grayson can put it up on the board, but it's really a well done book, and I hope it gets Tulip Fever, that's it. It's really a well done book, and it's very interesting and very well done, and of course, it's a love story and all that, really paints a picture of the time. Paints a couple. You've got high society, and then you've got the maids, and you've got the sailors, and so you've got all levels of society involved in the story, and it'd make a great movie. Hope it gets made, but. Very, very interesting story. But anyway, that's Tulip Mania. Again, this is a little different than I was the first, I believe, and the only to put an Austrian analysis to this particular event. And again, it was the what Murray thought I had made somewhat of a contribution on. So I would open it up to questions. We are at approaching 7:30 Central Time. I don't know what the public chat's been all about. I see no questions necessarily. I did put up a post today that I had found from Mish. If any of you ever read him, Mike Shedlock, and he's got a very interesting piece on the China housing bubble, which we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about next week. We're going to talk about what are bubbles right now and what aren't, and I'm open to ideas. So please be thinking about that. I'd like you to look around and see what you think. Of course, I've already showed my hand that I think government debt really at all levels and Chinese real estate are really the issues, and those are the readings that I've put up. But you may have other ideas, and I think that'd be interesting to kick around. I thought the interesting thing about this and I made a mistake. I said housing market in Japan. I meant China, of course. So I apologize for that. I meant China. But it said here that the party leaders always get bailed out first. And I thought that would be reminiscent for some of you to in terms of how John Law was able to get the king out of the Mississippi bubble. First, and the powerful and connected tend to get their money and be able to go. So I thought that was interesting in this particular case. I do have a question. So, does Tulip Mania show that you can have a bubble without fiat money, but that the impact of the bubble is much less deep and broad than it would be? Excuse me, with a central bank or fiat money in place. Well, that's well put, and there's probably, I think Bob Murphy's written something recently on this, because I think he's gotten a few questions like this in his class about whether you could have a bubble with hard money and all that kind of thing. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that you can have, whether the money's paper money or whether it's a discovery of silver or gold, that floods into a market, the value, the more money there is, the value of that goes down, and thus, so yeah, I think you can have a bubble without fiat money. I think that, but that bubble doesn't permeate through. Throughout the entire economy. The other thing we had going here was essentially a futures market. We had that potential for credit. So not only did you have the money in place through the Bank of Amsterdam, but you also had the credit aspect that we've talked about so many times with the small amount of money down, so on and so forth. But it does end quickly. This is not a situation like the Mississippi bubble or the enduring bubble that we have in the United States economy since we went off the last semblance of the gold standard in 1971. We've had one series of bubbles after another. And if you have a central bank, John Law kept his bubble afloat for quite a few many years. South Sea bubble could not because the Bank of England did not participate. If they had, that bubble would have lasted a lot longer. And so yeah, I think that certainly you could have some sort of boom, but it would correct very quickly. Was the Bank of Amsterdam involved in setting interest rates prior to during the actual mania? No, that's a good question. In fact, They weren't, but I know I was asked as part of getting this published that interest rates had actually gone down in that area. And yeah, I've got I went to Homer and Celia, who essentially wrote the history of interest rates, and Sidney Homer, Richard Celia, the history of interest rates, and I went back and looked at interest rates. Bank of Amsterdam didn't set them, but Dutch interest rates declined sharply in the 17th century, and then of course tulip futures could be traded with no margin. So you did have plenty of opportunities to speculate, but like all booms, interest rates did go down during during that period. But it's not that the Bank of Amsterdam was setting those. Was setting those rates because they were. So, of course, fine reg got passed today, financial regulation. So you should be able to sleep better at night, knowing the 2,300 pages of financial regulation was passed, and I believe that. Somebody has said that this will help the government deal with any future crashes and panics, or make it maybe keep it from happening, which I think is complete nonsense. Actually, the financial regulation bill will serve to further consolidate the banking industry, and because it will be further consolidated, we're probably more likely to have panics and crashes and institutions that get very big, and financial products get created that over time increase leverage, and so yeah, I don't think that went away today with President Obama's signature. Paul was in Houston, was kind enough to send me the piece about Bernanke, and I believe that he said something to the effect that. Said the outlook for the economy is unusually uncertain. Unusually uncertain. That's very interesting comment for a Fed chair. It's that probably means that since these guys are always wrong, that actually it's probably an absolute certainty that things are going to get much worse. And I know the unemployment rate, at least in Vegas, was announced the other day. It's now 14.5, which is the highest unemployment rate that Vegas has ever had. I think it's still 9.5 nationwide, so still got a huge amount of unemployment. Office vacancies, and the housing market, of course, has fallen off a cliff again after the temporary stimulus that happened, and is not there now. So without paying people $8,000, they're not going to buy these homes, and so the housing market will return to crumbling, and. Again, I would contend that the commercial real estate market, as I'm sure I've said before many, many times here, is fairly early stages of its of its correction. I think it's got more to go down. So stock market, interestingly enough, seems to be kind of hanging around, going nowhere. But it's just, one gets the idea that maybe we get to the fall, which is kind of crash season for the market. That maybe we'll have another event. But also, I don't know if you saw the 1099 news on gold sales. Gold dealers are now anytime they pay. Of course, this goes for anybody, any small business. You're gonna have to 1099 anybody that you pay a more than $600 a year for any goods or services for your business. Well, if you're a gold dealer and you buy gold from a customer, say I go to my gold dealer and I go, gee, I need some paper money for this gold to pay bills, and it's more than $600, then they're going to be issuing me a 1099, and which, of course, gets reported to the IRS. So gold dealers don't like it. They're going to have to produce a lot of paper. Small business is going to have to produce a lot of paper. I can't imagine that the IRS is staffed up to handle all these 1099s. But again, it's not exactly like John Law going door to door, taking people's gold from the houses, or FDR confiscating gold. But it's a very interesting development that if you did have a spike in gold and you had a lot of people try to sell, then the government is going to be standing there wanting to get some tax dollars from it. And then the tricky part will be, is what is your basis in that gold? And do you have proof in some sort of audit of what your price might have been? Yeah, so it's a very interesting. It made me think of some of what we've talked about before. The government doesn't like gold. They don't. Gold is essentially the people's money, and I doubt if they would confiscate it at this point, because I don't think they'd get very much of it. But a much more likely target is them wanting to convert everybody's 401ks into government bonds or something like that. I mean, that I could see very quickly. But taking gold, it's hard for me to imagine, because gold ownership is just not that common. They certainly are looking to get their pound of flesh in terms of taxes. So that's another troubling development. So, any other questions? I don't have any new products in front of me tonight. I know that we've got a nice fall lineup of classes. If you're thinking about that, Bob Murphy's going to teach kind of an introductory class in economics. He's written a book, Lessons for the Young Economist, really geared kind of for high schoolers. I think it's wonderful opportunity. I think we've got David Gordon, who's going to teach, and David, for those of you who don't know him, is pretty much considered the smartest guy in any room. Tom Woods is going to teach a class, and of course he's a big star, and Tom DiLorenzo is going to teach class this fall. So please keep us in mind on your fall schedule. Next week we've got Mises University happening here in Auburn, and it will be the biggest ever. We're going to have probably 240 students here, and so by far it'll be the biggest we've ever had. So we're very, very excited about that. Despite all that going on, we will have class next Wednesday evening. after classes are over here. I hope they're over. And so anyway, next week is a big week at the Mises Institute, of course, in September 18th. I'm sorry, we're going to be in Colorado Springs. I think it's called the Myth of Good Government or something like that. I know my talk is a piece that I wrote for Hans Hoppe's Fetschrift, and I use a little Abraham Maslow and Hoppean theory as to why democracy won't work. And then, of course, in October 8th and 9th, we've got our Supporters Summit here, a very special event, because Jim Rogers will be here to accept the Schlarbaum Award. So if there's any opportunity that you've ever thought about coming to Auburn to see us, see the Institute, seeing Jim Rogers might be just the excuse you were looking for. So he will, you see him on TV, he lives in Singapore, but he's an old Alabama boy. So he's coming back and he's going to speak to us in October. We've got an event in Furman, which is up in Greenville, South Carolina, and 13th of November, I think, coming up. We've got a high school program coming. Of course, we're going to be in Houston 22nd of January next year. And we're taking our high school program on the road in Houston on the 21st. So a little bit of a doubleheader for us. Beginning of next year. We're booking Chicago, by the way. If any of you are in the Chicago area and wondering, gee, when are you ever going to do something in Chicago, I think we're going to be in Chicago in April of next year. So anyway, a lot of things coming up, and I'm obviously filling time because, you know, somebody thinks I'm getting an Alabama accent already. Well, you know, you're the actor, Robert, but I'm not sure I'm getting I'm getting quite the draw yet, but you do remember I'm from Abilene, Kansas, so there's a little bit of a Kansas draw anyway, but anyway, as you can tell, I'm just killing time to see if there's any questions. Seeing none, I think we'll call it a night. At this point, I'm going to turn it back to Grayson. Why don't I say a little bit about the grading? I'm out. Or am I still on?